because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Leader Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, tiny-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.
At the Races with Steve Bick.
Enough!
Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back a couple of minutes into hour two on this Tuesday, and always a pleasure, typically during the Triple Crown, because that's when the most weighty opinions and the most elegant prose is delivered. Right? That's where the songs and stories, where they come home to roost. Tim Layden joins us. Tim, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Steve. I don't know about elegant prose, but definitely eyeballs.
Well, and always intriguing. The storylines write themselves. Whether it's 80-1 shots, becoming the second longest price in the history of the Derby, then demurring from participation in the Triple Crown until Belmont. There's always something that. I call it the greatest unscripted drama, Tim, and it's really true.
Yeah, it is true, and I think that's why I don't want to dive into this right away, but I think that's part of the reason that, we should tread lightly when we talk about changing the Triple Crown, because, storylines do generate eyeballs, and the Triple Crown, as currently constructed, certainly produces storylines, and I think once you change that, be careful what you ask for. It'll be a completely different animal. But, this year has certainly been an interesting 2.5 weeks at this point, and we'll see where it takes us in the next 3 weeks. And I'll be convinced that Rich Strike is running the Belmont when he gets into the starting gate.
Do you want to elaborate a little bit about, first of all, we got 2 weeks worth of copy. Take us back to Kentucky first, and let's unfold these first two classics.
Sure. In Kentucky, I think that, just to relate the way that played out for me, the print media, and I guess I'm still half print media, working for a television network and doing some TV work, but still writing stories, obviously. Most of us that don't have to, as they say, hit the button right when the winner crosses the finish line on a real hardcore morning newspaper deadline, most of us watch the race out on the turf course because that sort of gives you a little bit of a buffer from the crowd and quick access to people when the race ends. And it's a setup that Darren Rogers and the people at Churchill Downs have given us that makes us able to do our job. So I was out there on the turf course with, Jody Demling and Pat Forty and Dane O'Neill, Claire Crosby, a bunch of others. And you kind of watch the race on the screen, and then you avert your gaze down to the track, and then you look up at the screen and back to the track, and you try and pick up fractions. And, obviously, like every other person of the 120,000 in the crowd, except maybe Eric Reed and his family, we saw the event. Well, first of all, we saw it going way too fast. And I think that sets off a little alarm for all of us when we see 21.78, because the history of the Derby is that when they go that fast, crazy things happen. But then once they left the quarter pole and got into the stretch, we got Epicenter making a great move to the lead, and then we got Zandon coming to his side, and that's the race we all talked about. And I think I was focused on those two horses until, about the same time that Larry Kalmus was focused on those two horses, and then saw a horse come by on the inside and looked up at the screen, looked out at the track, looked up at the screen, and I thought, wow, that's the two horse. Who's the two horse? And then just at the last instant, I caught the rest of the saddle cloth and saw 21, and by then the place had gone quiet and the other people around me are yelling, oh my God, Rich Strike. And then there's just a complete intellectual reset. And it goes back to Mind That Bird and standing with Steve Haskin and looking at each other and saying, I got nothing. Which is to say, reporting now starts at square one, because we know nothing about this horse or the connections, and are completely shocked that he won the Kentucky Derby. And we went from there. And then obviously we got ourselves a couple days down the road, and we had the big disappointment that he wasn't running in the Preakness, although, in my opinion, a completely understandable decision. I don't think it falls, strictly speaking, under the category of horse welfare, in that the horse was not slightly injured and trying to avoid getting injured worse. It was just a trainer sort of straddling the line between taking care of his horse and placing his horse properly. I think that Eric Reed did not run Rich Strike in the Preakness, not entirely to protect the horse, but to give his horse the best chance to succeed, but a little bit of both. And then we went from there and we got the Preakness, and I think, certainly I thought Epicenter would win that one, but the race did not go the way Steve Asmussen wanted it to go, and then we got Early Voting, who's certainly looked like a serious racehorse in that race, but he will not be in the Belmont, so that narrative plays out a little further as we get only Rich Strike in the Belmont, probably. And then this has all been overshadowed. I shouldn't say overshadowed. It's all been overridden by a very robust conversation about whether we should change the Triple Crown to try and ensure that more of the best three-year-olds run at least two and maybe all three of the races, and that remains an interesting conversation, and I remain a willing listener to that discussion, but not an advocate for that change. I guess that's where I am right now on Tuesday, May 24th.
And I know that later, I think Andy Serling, when he joins us, is going to opine on the Triple Crown question, but I mean, I've never even considered that there would be any action. I mean, taken even pre American Pharoah and subsequently Justify. It's amazing that we would be only a couple of years removed, Tim, from a pair of Triple Crown winners, and yet people by one oddity that hasn't happened since 1982, one oddity has got people carrying on. And what you just said, in fact, Chuck Simon, I thought, wrote a really great little blurb about don't mess with the one thing that everybody agrees is the centerpiece of the racing calendar. Why would you, the one thing that the general public is interested in, they're not that interested in the Breeders' Cup. That's an industry thing and a horse player thing. But the Triple Crown attracts outside interest. And why would you try to, stretching it out over 3 months, over 60 days, it just completely takes its intrigue, its charm, its challenge, and completely mutes it.
I agree with you, and I am sensitive and receptive to the discussion, and I understand that it's an interesting discussion. I also agree with you that it's not something that's going to happen. There are, again, three different racing commissions and way too many moving parts and way too many vested interests for that to actually happen. But it's an interesting discussion in the same way that, you know, that we talk about trading football or baseball or basketball players who are absolutely not going to be traded. Those kind of discussions keep the sports talk, and by talk I mean internet talk and radio talk and TV talk and print talk. It keeps that industry bubbling. And I don't think it's completely without merit to suggest that if the Preakness was a month after the Derby, that we would get perhaps, I don't think there's any guarantees in this, that we would perhaps get some more Derby horses, or be more certain to get the Derby winner into the Preakness. But gosh, just like you said, 1982, and go to spend a buck, 1985, that's a long, long time ago, the last time this happened under these circumstances. Country House was not in that category. Grindstone was not in that category. So I think those are different considerations. What I tried to write in my piece for NBCSports.com after the Preakness was, can we just not make the Triple Crown only valid if a horse runs the first two legs and has a chance to win the third or wins the third? Can we not just crater in our interest if the Derby winner doesn't go to the Preakness? It's still a thing. There's still, Epicenter was still there. Simplification was still there. Let's just open up our minds a little bit and not make this a boom or bust type event. And also, as you alluded to, let's realize that this was done twice, very recently, which means it can be done. And the idea that 2 weeks is too soon for a horse to, everybody jumps on this idea that, oh my goodness, the breed has changed so much. The breed is not hardy enough to come back in 2 weeks. Nobody wheels horses back in 2 weeks. Some of that is true, but at the same time, you know, there are trainers. Baffert is one of them. I know Baffert is toxic to talk about right now, but let's just say that one thing that he always said was that if you have the Derby winner on the first Saturday in May, that means you have a pretty darn fit horse to come back 2 weeks later, just kind of wrap him in bubble wrap and come back in 2 weeks, and he's still going to be a fit horse. Is he going to be tired sometimes? Sure. And do different trainers have different philosophies? Of course. But I just don't think this is an ironclad truth that the modern thoroughbred can't come back in 2 weeks and run a mile in 3/16 and win again or be competitive again. I think it's sometimes true and sometimes isn't. And the very fact that Rich Strike didn't run generated discussion and interest for the Preakness and for the sport. I just don't think you can have a perfect situation where 14 of the 20 Derby horses load into the gate in the Preakness and we get a rerun. It's not supposed to be a rerun. You know, it's supposed to be an entirely different event in athletic structure and in organic structure, the way it is, the infield, the bands. Everything is different about Pimlico on the second or third Saturday in May than Churchill. And the Belmont is also different. So I like it the way it is. I don't think it'll change, but I'm not a scold about it, but I'm not, and I'm receptive to the discussion for its merits, but not because I want it to happen.
And there's a few things about that, Tim, that can be expanded on. And when you talk about the organic nature, there's constantly, and it's one of the challenges that the Breeders' Cup faces, and not just the Breeders' Cup, other big grade one signposts along any season, you know, the hope is that you're going to assemble a certain set of horses and they're all going to come together, or, you know, these potential candidates, let's say for the Met Mile, you know, there was the whole, you know, can we get Life is Good and Flightline and you know, all the various horses that suddenly had bubbled to the surface, you know, as potential candidates to, you know, to be involved in a showcase race. And, you know, people seem to think that, oh, you know, that never happens anymore. Well, it didn't happen back then either, plenty of times. I mean, horses have been having a hoof issue, or have gotten a little sick, spiked the temperature. That's been going on for as long as they've been, you know, racing horses. So the organic portion of this is a little bit of Wheel of Fortune.
Of course. And you know, it's interesting. And looking, you know, we talked about the 82-85 situation with the Derby to the Preakness. I mean, I realized that last week in our fast-moving culture that we live in now, last week was a long time ago. But in the 1950s, there were 5 horses that didn't go from the Derby to the Preakness. And by then, the current time setup was in place. And, you know, I don't, maybe there was outrage back then, but gosh, 5 out of 10, that's a pretty big number. And I think you're right that over the course of the long-term and near-term history of the sport, there have been a lot of horses that have not made it to the big race for various reasons. And you talked about the grade one structure, and how does that change things if you, obviously the lineup that comes forth when people talk about changing the Triple Crown is, let's move the Preakness to the first weekend in June. And first of all, is everybody at Pimlico and Stronach okay with that? And then let's move the Belmont to the first weekend in July. Is everybody at NYRA okay with that? I'm sure that those aren't going to be easy changes to make, and that's why neither of us thinks that they'll be made. But if you run the Belmont 1.5 miles on July, you know, 3rd, 4th, 5th, whatever it might be, what does that do to the Haskell? What does that do to, you know, the Jim Dandy, the Whitney? You know, what does it do to the Pacific Classic or the Travers? You know, it just, Pennsylvania Derby, which has become a pretty cool race, in the 2000s. I think it upends everything. You get an awful lot of good 3-year-olds that take time off after the Derby, the Preakness, or the Belmont, whichever one was their last race. And I know that if we're going to say that all that matters is the Triple Crown, then you say, who cares about that stuff? But, you know, Saratoga, Del Mar, those are big venues for this sport. And do you want to chip away at that by dragging the Triple Crown into July? Maybe you do. But I'm just saying it's worth having that discussion.
Well, my counter to that would be that for as much as people enjoy the Breeders' Cup, for instance, think about the damage it's done to the races that were for a century the fall championship races, certainly at Belmont, but even the races at Santa Anita and anywhere else, you know, that the Keeneland, any place that's running fall races that feed in now to the Breeders' Cup, Breeders' Cup is a monolith, and when you've got a race like the Jockey Club Gold Cup being uprooted and moved to Saratoga to essentially make it more relevant and to keep it, you know, to keep it viable, that is the unintended consequence of what the Breeders' Cup became, you know, this 800-pound gorilla. There, and you bring up a perfect example of you know, then, you know, the tidal wave that's created, you know, down the road at Monmouth for the Haskell and at Saratoga for Jim Dandy Travers, etc. You also, Belmont Day in July is not Belmont Day. I mean, if you want to go spend, if people thought it was hot, if they thought that it was hot at Pimlico this weekend, go to Belmont in July. It's going to be hot like you wouldn't believe. The other thing about this, Tim, is it's not the same. It's not the same event for a very important reason. The aging and the development curve of sophomore Colts and Phillies, there's a specific benefit about their performance level and their development level in that five-week period and how it hits. If you tinker with this, you're going to tinker with all the lead up. What about all the races at Fairgrounds and at Gulfstream and at Oaklawn and everywhere else? This is just idiotic pablum that people think that there's a problem and that doesn't exist.
Yes, and I think also, I understand that, you know, you have to wear your body armor when you have that discussion, because if you tell people that the tradition of the Triple Crown is important, people will come at you with two things. Number one, it hasn't always been Derby 2 weeks, Preakness 3 right. weeks, Belmont. Okay, it hasn't. It's been that way for a long, long time, though. The other thing that people come at you with is, oh, you know, you're just being, you're being just a fuddy-duddy about this, because sports change all the time. Baseball once did not have a designated hitter. Baseball once did not have black players. Basketball did not have a three-point shot. These are fundamental changes to the structure of those sports, and that's absolutely true. But I don't think that horse racing is at the point. Here's the other thing. For 37 years, or let's say the last 20 of those 37 years, people wrung their hands over the lack of a Triple Crown winner, and the speech that you would get was always that horse racing's popularity is ebbing. We just need a Triple Crown winner. That'll change everything. Then people will care. And, okay, American Pharoah was a Triple Crown winner. People cared until about 48 hours after the Belmont. Justify was a Triple Crown winner. People cared until about 48 hours after the Belmont. Then we went right back to baseline. You don't change the fundamental position of horse racing in the zeitgeist by having a horse win the Triple Crown. It's a very cool thing. It's a great story. It's fun to cover. It's fun to watch. It's fun to cover and watch even when the horse falls short, although in kind of a gutting sort of way, you know. But I mean, I still have fever dreams watching Birdstone catch Smarty Jones. But, you know, at the same time, those things didn't change the sport. It's just three races. It's cool. And when someone wins it, it has tremendous historical importance because it's only happened 13 times. But then if you change it and make it 4 weeks, everyone says, the public will reset, and that's probably true that eventually the public will reset. But they'll always, the future writers will always have to put in a parenthetical or comma splice phrase saying that, you know, so-and-so, you know, this horse named, you know, Steve Dick Greenwich, you know, this great three-year-old that was named after this great radio host of the 90s and 80s, 90s, and 2000s, won the Triple Crown. But remember, the Triple Crown is different now. It's 8 weeks instead of five. And we're going to have to say that over and over again. Does it matter? It does to me. It clearly doesn't to everybody.
Well, the focus and, not to drag the network into it, but some of this discussion, at least, it feels like it. The network is driving, and whether it's, you know, whether it's just to be provocative, which it probably is, because Naira is not moving the Belmont. It still provokes more discussion, so it's good for the game. You know, there were a few things too, Tim, that we got to touch on in your piece, because you didn't just write the the postscript to Preakness. You also wrote about Wayne Lucas coming into the weekend. He caught your interest. And as always, because the venue is itself historic, I loved the way you couched Pimlico's role in the weekend, you know, as the backdrop. It's basically, you called it, I think, obstinate in its creakiness. It says, yeah, I'm still here, and I'm not going anywhere yet.
Yeah, you know, the first Preakness I covered for Sports Illustrated was 2002, which was Poor Emblem, and I referred to Pimlico in that story 20 years ago as a toe-tag relic. And 20 years later, it's still there. You know, I think we all expect it to fall down one of these years. And, you know, obviously the old grandstand at the head of the stretch is closed now forever, I'm sure. But, you know, it's still there. And, you know, maybe we need to ease up on that storyline. You know, it's, you know, Pimlico is what Pimlico is, and they're not. I think there's talk of a serious renovation, and that would be nice. But you know, the Pimlico's age and wear always become part of the story. And you know, I'm amazed at that track. I had a conversation with my good buddy Tim Wilkin, you know, from former Albany Times Union writer and tremendous horse racing writer. And when I saw what the temperature was going to be at Pimlico that week, I sent Tim a text and said, okay, let's start a pool. What's going to go first on Saturday? Is it going to be the toilets or the electricity? And Tim texted back and said, neither. It's going to be the elevator. So it's, you know, the elevator to the press box, which we all get on. And then, you know, if you're, you know, if you were raised a Catholic altar boy like me, you make the sign of the cross and then watch the door close. You know, it's still there, and it's always part of the story. And I'm not saying that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it's, you know, Pimlico is part of the story of the Preakness. And, you know, Steve, Churchill Downs is really not part of the story of the Derby anymore. Except, you know, you've got those poor, sad twin spires sitting there overlooking the finish line, 50 feet shorter than the giant concrete structures on either side of them, which is fine. That's to accommodate more people, more celebrities, make more money, make it a bigger event. There's plenty of good reason to do that. But, you know, Churchill Downs is now like the Cowboys Stadium, or it's like the Golden State Warriors giant arena. It's not, it no longer has character and charm. It's just a giant, modern, sporting event structure. And Pimlico, you know, I just made the sign of the cross again. It's going to fall down someday, but it has character and charm. You cannot take that away.
No, and we covered extensively with on Thursday with Alan Foreman. Alan brought everybody up to speed on the redevelopment plan and the timing and the progress. You know, there's been some added complexities as he laid out. The elevator had a very good week, Tim. I will the elevator, because Marty McGee, one of the reasons Marty didn't come, he's got knee replacement surgery coming up, and he said I cannot take a chance that I've got to hoof it up those four flights. And I completely understand that, having on occasion having to carry my radio equipment up those four flights. But the elevator was flawless this week.
The elevator on the morning line was 50-1 and cashed, I think, is what happened. You know? But I'll say this. I take the elevator on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, but I never take the elevator on Saturday. I always take the stairs. And
oh, that's great.
I even take the stairs walking down out of the press box at 11 o'clock after writing my story, because I just don't want to jinx myself after 20 years of never getting on that elevator on Saturday. So it's I'm glad it made it through, but it wasn't going to take me down with it. So
That's a great policy. There's a story in that itself, actually, that any number of other sports writers could write. One thing too, before I ask you about your conversation with Wayne Lucas, since we're talking about Baltimore and the environs, And in fact, not to direct people to other written word and other stories about the Preakness, but Joe Drape wrote a really nice piece about not just the race, but about Seth Klarman and his part in all of this, having literally grown up blocks away from Pimlico, in the neighborhood. We discussed this with Alan Foreman again on Thursday. Every year we have a segment that, is devoted to, the hopes and aspirations for Park Heights. But Seth Klarman's role in now winning a second Preakness, it can't be overlooked. I'm going to bring it up with Chad in a few minutes.
Oh, sure. I mean, and Seth is obviously a very successful guy who's very low key about his success in the business and the business that he made his money in. And he's good for the sport, and the Seth Klarman, having grown up in Baltimore as a very middle class kid, was a great angle when cloud computing won in 2017, and again now. There was a very good piece written, and I'm trying to find it, that I referenced in my story, what really Park Heights is to Baltimore. And to be honest, with all the Preaknesses I've covered, I never fully understand. The story is written in the Baltimore Banner, by a young poet named Wallace Lane. And it's linked in my game story. And it's really, we can all write about, even Seth Klarman, the first thing he said on Saturday when he was asked about, being a Baltimore guy winning the Preakness a second time, and he immediately said, I've spent, Seth is 65, and I think he said, I've spent, most of my life in Boston. Probably more than four decades. He left Park Heights to go to Cornell when he was 17 years old, and really hasn't been back. And he, to his everlasting credit, did not overplay his hand on that. He wanted to make that clear that he doesn't live in Baltimore anymore, and cities change and neighborhoods change. And I'm guessing that Park Heights is a very different place now than it was when Seth Klarman was growing up. But I recommend that piece that Wallace Lane wrote in the Baltimore Banner, which, me being a white sports writer from NBC Sports or previously from Sports Illustrated, I can't understand what it's like to live in and or grow up in or suffer in or strive in Park Heights. And I just can't. I could interview 1,000 people and not answer that question. But he does in that piece that he wrote, and I think it's a tremendously useful piece in understanding the relationship between the Preakness and the neighborhood that it exists in, which isn't unique to sports, but it's increasingly unique. We've seen a suburbanization of stadiums and arenas if anything, a widening of the gap between the people in the arena and the people in the neighborhoods or the cities that support those teams. And I think Pimlico, although racing is certainly a more affordable ticket than a lot of sports, but at its highest end, it's a long way from Seth Klarman to the people in Park Heights parking cars on their lawns. Not in terms of where Seth grew up, but in terms of their station in American society. And I think it's helpful to always be aware of that, wherever we are covering sports, but certainly at Pimlico.
Tim Layden's with us. Got a couple more minutes before Chad Brown visits. And Tim, I referenced your advanced piece that focused on Dwayne Lucas, and the Philly had kind of the same difficulties and rough trip scenario that impeded her a little and kept her from impacting the Arkansas Derby further, but she's obviously, you know, the leading for now, the leading 3-year-old filly. As I said to Jay Pridman on Friday, Wayne Lucas is not the retiring type.
No, and he's really. I mean, Steve, you knew Wayne Lucas back when. When he was sort of when he ruled the world, and it's fun to see athletes, coaches, whomever, actors, whoever it might be, stick around long enough to become beloved. And Wayne Lucas was not beloved in the 1980s and in the late 70s, mid-80s into the 90s, but he was a big winner, and he could be difficult to work with. He had a big ego, but he also, it's not bragging if it's fact. He changed the game, and now he stayed in the game, and it's interesting. His old business manager, David Burridge from Oklahoma, said that, you have to understand that the reason, and I quoted this in the story, that Wayne does what he does and still does it with the same passion is because he really loves one thing more than anything else, and it isn't close. And I'm not saying more than any other person. I'm saying more than any other thing. But Wayne has said, and others have said, that Wayne's passion for racing has been a gift to racing, but it's cost him. It's cost him relationships. It's cost him sort of more of a breadth of richness of life. But that's the gift that he's given racing fans. And I think racing fans need to understand that, that Wayne has sacrificed. And I'm not even sure he knows how much, but because he loves what he does so much. For this Preakness, it was nice to have Wayne sitting at the end of that shed row in his cowboy hat and his boots and, as Jay noted, his freshly pressed white shirt. He gave this year's Preakness more than it would have had without him. And we needed it without Rich Strike. I don't want to go back to our original discussion, but the lack of a Derby winner, while it shouldn't drag the Preakness into irrelevance, it's a theme. But Wayne bringing that filly there and bringing himself there gave us all something to talk about beyond what we would have had without him, and that was a very cool thing. And he's I'm just not sure there's ever been anybody quite like him in racing. I mean, there were obviously much older trainers a long time ago, but the sport was different, and he's really just been a singular character in the sport for a very long time. And Steve, I remember the first time I interviewed Wayne at length was at Saratoga when I worked for the Albany Times Union in 1986. And I'm telling you, walking up to Wayne at his barn in the morning as a 29-year-old writer from the Albany Times Union and asking D. Wayne Lucas for several hours of his time was, my heart was racing. And, but he gave it, and he let me talk to others. And I wrote a story that wasn't all complimentary, and he shook my hand and said, "You did a good job," and I disagree with some things. And we went forward from there. And he's just really a remarkable part of racing, and there's no other way to frame it.
Well, each setting and each opportunity in this 5-week period. They can be cohesive. They could be fresh hands. Sometimes they bring all the cards in together and they deal from the cards, that same stack. Other time they bring in a fresh deck. And we've gotten what feels like some fresh decks, and we'll have it again in 2 weeks in New York. Tim Layden, it is always a pleasure to see you and to talk to you at these venues, and then to have a chance to share your thoughts with our audience.
Yeah, thank you for having me on, Steve.
Always great. Tim Layden, everybody, who, of course, you follow on Twitter, and by Tim Layden, two of our best guests and conversationalists go by the same, right? By Tim Layden and by Sean Clancy, using the byline approach. That works. I'm going to, I'm really glad that, that's always, I'm always glad that Tim joins us, but I'm really glad he mentioned the, the piece by Wallace Lane in the Baltimore Banner, and I will, I'll send out the link to that. It's poignant and honest and interesting for those that wouldn't ordinarily, you know, seek out a voice from Park Heights and from the neighborhood. Chad Brown is going to join us, and earlier we talked to Jose Ortiz to celebrate early voting's Preakness win, and it's a pleasure to do it with Chad. Chad, congratulations to you, Seth, Jose, and the whole team.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Not at all. And I speculated on Monday that this felt for you and Seth particularly, and Jose for different reasons, his first Preakness, but it really felt like this was even more celebratory than cloud computing's win.
Yeah, it really was. They're both so special. A little extra special, you know, of course, being on Seth's birthday, it just seemed like everything came together with this plan to do this, and it was just a huge, you know, relief and flood of emotions when the horse finally hit the wire, because there's so much planning involved.
Talk about it, and at what point, as these horses develop and as you're, you know, as you're molding them, as you're reacting, you know, to their circumstances, you could really weave in Jack Christopher into this and even Zandon too, and just talk about how your, you know, how your view of them collectively and your planning works from the time they, you know, they get started as 2-year-olds even.
Yeah, well, you know, we get them in like most people do, and you start training them and observing them and getting to know the horses, and you start to set them on a certain path and direction. And then, as a trainer, you got to be flexible, and you're not always right, and you got to change course sometimes and kind of tilt them off the path a little bit, a different direction, as you get to learn about them. So, with these horses, they've always showed plenty of ability. They're all different, those three colts. And if you have, you know, super talented team that you've been working with and training and good chemistry, as you know, gives you a lot of options developing these horses, and you know, they really deserve most of the credit. My staff, it's a well deserved win, and all these three horses you just mentioned is the hard work and that they put into working with these horses.
How quickly, Chad, and of course, when even in the case of some of these as purchases, this was a $200,000 yearling. They're identified, you know, in some cases specifically as classic candidates, and that's all well and good, you know, until the rubber meets the road. How quickly for you, as your application against the Triple Crown races, how quickly do you, in the process, say to yourself, this could be a Preakness horse, this could be a Belmont horse, this is a Derby horse?
Yeah, it just depends on the horse. I mean, this particular horse, early voting, was a good-looking yearling, recommended by Mike Ryan, who we do so much work together, I've had so much success, and And like I alluded to in the press conference, you know, it's teamwork. It's Rude and Riddle does the vetting for us, led by Scott and Debbie Pierce and other veterinarians behind them. And then Niall Brennan got the horse to break the horse for us that we've done a lot of work with, and he's a great partner of ours. And he identified the horse very early as a horse that had ability, that he might not be an early horse, ironically, but that he showed plenty of ability as a baby, plenty of class, and he was, you know, a keeper. So then when we got him, you know, Stevie took some time, you know, all summer. He just wasn't ready for Saratoga, and we don't push our horses, fast as they need to go. So, you know, if they're ready, like a Jack Christopher, to, you know, have some dazzling debut at Saratoga, I'm not going to hold them back, and we let them run. We've had plenty of those through the years, but, you know, if they're a horse that needs a little more time, like Early Voting or Zandon, we just skip the meet with them, and we pointed the Belmont with both those horses, and, you know, it really paid off. In Early Voting's cases, it spilled over into Aqueduct. So when we worked the horse from the gate and got him right ready to run in the fall, we started to really see that this horse could be something. And it's going to take a little time and distance to really see the best of him. But, you know, we set him on that course, and it worked out.
And it's interesting, too, because when you look at how things have unfolded for the three of them at this juncture, you know, here we are two-thirds of the way through Triple Crown, and they each took different paths, and like you went out of your way 2 weeks ago after Pat Day Mile to laud what Dr. Bramlage, his contribution to getting Jack Christopher to that point. And you know, Chad, as much as anybody, your management style, because that's what this is. I mean, it is a management role. There's so many working parts, and if anybody's listening, you know, to you discuss everything along the way, it becomes very evident how much you're weaving together to have the success that you have.
Yeah, no, it's it's very well said. There's a lot of moving parts, and there's a lot of teamwork involved, and of course you have to have the horses, and it's not lost on these incredible athletes when you identify them, and at the end of the day, it's up to their talent and bravery to go out there and run to the best of their ability, and get back to the horse. I mean, I'm just so proud of him. This horse he's done everything we've asked him to do. He breaks well. He makes his own trips. You know, he carries his speed. He has a nice race record. He may not have run many times, but in your fourth start, you know, he went a classic race. It's a special horse. It's not easy to do. And, I just couldn't be more proud of him.
Well, and you really elucidated that as well when you said if you go ahead and just take the golden ticket, the perceived golden ticket to the Derby, you take this horse, you put him in this meat grinder, you throw him into one of the fastest paces in Derby history, and you're not going to have anything left afterwards, 2 weeks. And instead, you've got a classic winner.
Yeah, those decisions are not easy. I mean, when everything works out on this end, it looks easy, and it makes a lot of sense, right? The way you laid it out, but and we saw it the same way. Of course, it's not easy though. I mean, the Derby, it's what everyone shoots for. It's the race you want to win, and it's so hard to win for a reason. And when you have a horse that, has the points, and he's going to be one of the top, eight or ten choices in the race, he's in the top half of the field, it's really hard to say no. And it certainly doesn't look like it would have set up for him, like you said. It wouldn't have set up well to run back in the Preakness with him either. So we'll never know what would have happened, but it certainly looks like it was the right decision to just go to the Preakness.
I got to ask you this, because I know it's come up in a different format in previous conversations we've had over the years, when specifically talking about Seth Klarman, who is an idyllic owner who understands if you come to him and say, we're better off doing this. You've said before, he gives you a free hand. How difficult is it to bring other owners into that frame of mind?
I'm unfortunate. I work with several owners, really, that approach it is plenty to mention, and that approach it, very realistically, and appreciate the information and feedback I give them, and we try to manage all of our horses together as a team, and when you're having success in the barn, it certainly makes it easier for clients and partners to listen to you. You have established some credibility that way. I think that would be in any business. So, I'm in a fortunate position. We worked hard to get here to have those type of clients that are good to work with, and they send you the really good horses. And it's there's tough decisions. And I'll tell you, sometimes it doesn't matter how good a trainer you are or leader you are. You need feedback. And I have a lot of clients that, they provide some feedback that really makes a decision. So I think it's everything works best if everyone's on the same page, I think, what you're doing. There's you just have to have owners that shut up and listen to you. Those relationships aren't good either. So if you're all on the same page, and there's more brains and eyes looking at something and talking about it, I think that's something to be accepted, and that's a good situation. I don't think one person running the show in anything ultimately is the best situation. That's how I think. So, unfortunately for me, we have the right partnerships and teams.
And essentially, it's communication. And it's funny that whenever I have a conversation with an owner or with somebody that advises owners, bloodstock side, trainers, invariably, if you had to distill one word to generate success, it's communication and having a good flow that way, and certainly let's fold Jose Ortiz back into this. You went out of your way to express what a team player he was with you. I brought it up with him last hour, and to tell everybody what you said to the room on Saturday if they missed it about Jose's approach.
With Jose, he started off with early voting with a couple wins in a row, and they had great chemistry together. And then he ended up going to the fairgrounds and riding Zandon in the Risen Star when previous jockey took off to ride Epicenter, Rosario, which, by the way, is understandable. And he ended up proving right in that race. And Jose, we put him on that horse, and he hopped at the start and lost all chance. Jose rode the horse fine in that race after that, and it wasn't his fault that he jumped out of the gate. It just didn't work out. So this next start, they're running on the same day, and early voting is, in the wood, and Zandon's in the bluegrass, and, I didn't ask him what he wanted to do. I said, you're going to ride early voting, and he said, that's fine. Wherever you need me to go, boss, I'm going to go. And, at that time, he liked early voting. I'm not going to say he didn't want to go ride him, but at the time, the way Zandon ran with his running style and the way he had a terrific third off a layoff with a bad break, it certainly looked like he was the horse to beat in the bluegrass and a better possibility, a better percentage chance to win the Kentucky Derby at the time than early voting. He's been on, loose leads and hasn't been tested. And if I had asked Jose at that point, which I didn't, I'm thinking he maybe likely would have said, I'll just stay in Zandon because I got to shoot for the Derby. And I didn't ask him, and he didn't push. He said, "Look, wherever you need me to go, I want to go." And I said, "I want you to go ride that horse, and I think it's important that I keep you two horses, you two together, horse and jockey." And he said, "No problem." And that was the end of it. And he went up there and he rode a terrific race in defeat. And even though he lost, I kept him on that horse because he had nothing to do with the loss. Number one, and number two, for him being a team player and just doing what I asked without any argument or complaining or anything like that. That's his horse, win or lose. So, you know, he deserved to ride him back in the Preakness. I had 10 agents calling me to ride that horse. I'm not taking the guy off the horse. So he went there. He deserves that horse. He's ridden him great in every single one of his starts. And it makes my job easier when there's people to work with like him, that he's not about complaining about anything. He's about put me in, coach, and thank you. That's it.
Well, it pays off as, you know, your work and his ride and just everything comes together. Quick survey as the race unfolded and the way you watched it and your thoughts as everything played out.
Well, I expected we'd probably be on the lead, but we've been training this horse with a target, and he rates so kind and goes by. And I do believe he was waiting on horses in the wood is why he got beat by a good horse, by the way, that earned the
sure.
win. But I do think he was waiting on him. So I always prefer a target. He's just found himself on the lead because he breaks so well from the gate. Looking at it, sure looked still that we'd be on the lead. I was expecting to be, but we had a plan B in case somebody went. We weren't sure who. What it ended up being, the outside horse went on the first turn. I mean, I looked over Seth sitting right beside me, and I said, because we had talked about a couple scenarios, and I said, that's perfect. You're in good shape. And so I said to him. And then that was it. I mean, he had that target. And if anything, I got a little nervous turn for home when he passed him so easily that he'd start to wait again. And it's a long stretch. Mm-hmm. So fortunately, Jose had enough attention on him to get to the wire before Epicenter was sort of grinding away on the inside there and made it close.
And I mentioned to him, and he just said earlier, I floated out a little bit. You know, if anybody thought, oh, you know, he's getting out, he wanted him out there in case anybody came wide rallying. And then he took a peek when he saw nobody was coming outside. When he looked inside, he realized there's Epicenter, who he didn't see all race. And so he made sure that early voting would eyeball him if Epicenter and Joel got close. It was masterful. Everything about this, Chad, was just brilliantly executed. So well done.
Thank you. Well, thank you for acknowledging everybody. And it's you know, it always feels good when a plan comes together. They often don't in this game. So it was very gratifying.
Well, and finally, you got these three big boys. You got a big summer to lay out and to keep them all separated as spring turns to summer and fall.
Yeah, I mean, we're in a good position. He's got to keep them healthy at this point, like everybody knows. So, you know, these are brilliant horses. They're very fast, and you know, and those type of horses, you know, you got to pay some extra attention to keeping them healthy and sound. And we do our best, and if they all stay healthy, they should have good summers.
Chad, I appreciate this. I wanted to celebrate with you and pass along the thoughts and congratulations to Seth as well. Continued success. We'll talk soon.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
Not at all. Chad Brown, everybody. And there's his thoughts. No point in you know, dragging out the other eight or nine stake winners from the last 3 weeks. There'll be time down the road. Maybe at Belmont we'll get. I always say to him, I said, you know, we got to do a sit down and have a comprehensive. But that was perfect. Let's take the timeout. We're actually on time, shockingly, and Andy Serling is going to join us. Andy had a front row seat to all the festivities, and he made me laugh. We were talking after later on in the evening, and he said, I got a bunch of texts. People said, I saw you on TV. And Andy said, yeah, I'm on TV 4 days a week. Oh, look, there's Andy. Okay. There's, yeah. Then you can see him. You can see him on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Back after this, hour three, Andy Serling next, and at the bottom of the hour, Amy Cook, the executive director of the Texas Racing Commission, to discuss what she is basically demanding of HISA. Back after this, hour three at the races.
the latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Who are you betting on? How about an app created specifically for horse racing? Naira Bets. We specialize in thundering hooves, fist pumping, and boosting your bankroll with robust weekly promotions and offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all day and night, nationwide. Get the action and thrill of horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo Steve200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.
The Belmont Stakes returns to Belmont Park Saturday, June 11th. Tickets to the top of the stretch, the premier trackside picnic area with personal grills are almost sold out. Tickets to the Test of the Champion are on sale at BelmontStakes.com. Hurry before it's gone.
The Ponds family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and curb.